It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth to the south pole of the moon, thanks to a camera called ShadowCam in a Korean lunar orbiter, Denuri, I welcome Bob Zimmerman, who keeps the website Behind the Black, who will explain these connections and also a revelation about expectations of lunar colonies. Bob, a very good evening to you. ShadowCam, what has it picked up and what is the meaning? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. This is a story that has not been picked up in the press anywhere, and it's simply because the press release from the ShadowCam team was very conveniently didn't discuss this particular part of its image. In fact, they focused on this part of the image on the rim and talked about shadows, but you had to dig in to see that the picture included the interior of this crater. And the interior of this crater is a part of the crater and near the south pole of the moon that is considered to be permanently shadowed, which means it's very hopefully going to have ice inside it. It is also a place where other orbiters have detected hydrogen, and they think if it's hydrogen, it's got to be locked into a molecule, and water is the most likely thing, though not proven. And so ShadowCam on South Korea's first lunar orbiter, Denuri, it's an American instrument, ShadowCam, is actually designed to look at dark places at low exposures and able to see detail. In other words, you can't look at anything that's illuminated by the sun. This is illuminated by Earth light, probably, and very faint Earth light, but they have a camera that can look in dark places and get details. That's how ShadowCam's design. It's designed to look into the shadows, the permanently shadowed parts of the moon. And the idea is to look to see if there's ice there. And so this press release, they're probably studying the data from into the interior of this crater called Marvin. It's only about 16 miles from the south pole of the moon, where there's lots of permanently shadowed craters and where Artemis, the first manned mission from Artemis, is supposed to land. This crater, Marvin, it should have ice at its base. It's permanently shadowed. In fact, the whole crater is in shadow most of the time. But the picture doesn't appear to show that.
Right.
And it's interesting. The press release, you had to zoom out to see the whole picture, including the crater, because they focused entirely on the rim. And as I say, they're probably still analyzing the data. What we see inside the crater looks like a darker patch of pooled dust near the middle. But that doesn't look like ice. Now, it's very possible that the ice particles are infused within the dust itself, between molecules, and therefore not obvious. But that's the analysis that's going on right now, which is why they didn't include it in their press release. But from what I can tell, if there's ice at the base of this crater, it's not going to be easy to get at. If there's ice, it's hard to say there's any ice at all. And if that's the case, This rush hour of spacecraft for many nations to get to the moon's south pole to mine the ice to build colonies might discover that they don't have the ice they thought they would. Now, that could be there. It could also be very difficult to process, and that's going to
Let's stay in lunar orbit. What is Hokuto R1?
Well, Hokuto R1 is the first privately financed and built lunar lander. It's now in lunar orbit. It was built by a Japanese company called iSpace. It's in lunar orbit with a planned mid-April landing in the crater of Atlas, which is in the mid-latitudes of the northern hemisphere of the moon on the near side that we can see. So it's in orbit. Everything is functioning great. We just have to stand by. But the most interesting payload on board, commercial payload, is the United Arab Emirates Rashid Rover. And so this mission is an engineering test mission for iSpace. They had 10 milestones. The last, of course, is operating on the moon. They've now completed successfully 7 of the 10 milestones. And, of course, next is landing and operation on the moon. And we just have to wait and see.
Flashlight, another lunar probe, but it's in trouble. Why?
This is kind of like Hakuto R1. It's a technology test mission to make sure the engineers will work. In this case, they're testing a lot of technology for a planetary CubeSat. And Lunar Flashlight is kind of similar to a shadow cam in that it was going to use lasers to look into the shadowed areas of the moon. When it launched on Falcon 9 rocket in December, however, its thrusters, which are also an experimental new type of thruster for CubeSat, they were underperforming and didn't work right. And so it was unable to get into the course it was supposed to go to get into lunar orbit. They've been improvising to try to get there with one of the four thrusters that was working, but even that is not working right now. So they're still struggling to try to get it in orbit, but by end of April, they have until then to do it, and if they haven't, they failed. This is not a failed mission, though, because everything here was technology tests. So even if the thrusters aren't working right, they're going to analyze that data and figure out how to fix them for future CubeSats, giving them thrusters they can use to do very sophisticated planetary science.
The announcements from JAXA about the sample return from asteroid Ryugu, what have they discovered, Bob?
There have been a whole bunch of, over time, they release results. The newest results are that in the samples from Ryugu, they detected uracil. Uracil is one of the four bases that make up the RNA molecule. Uracil is the base that you remove and replace with thiamine to create DNA. But uracil is one of four, and the other three are adenine, cytosine, and guanine. What this really says is that these kind of complex molecules can form in our solar system relatively easy, it appears. It doesn't mean they found life, not at all, but it does appear that if you can find this kind of a molecule on an asteroid like Ryugu, it means it's not that difficult for our solar system.
Dimorphos is a binary asteroid, a big one, little one. And the experiment was to hit the little one with a projectile called DART. And the results were to determine whether this is a viable planetary defense. But they found something else after hitting Dimorphos. What's that, Bob?
Well, I don't never bought into the NASA argument that this was a mission to study planetary defense. Yes, but hitting an asteroid might be a solution, but they didn't really learn, as far as I'm concerned, that much in terms of planetary defense here. What this really was as a mission always, number one, always, no matter what that press release says, was to study asteroids. And by impacting a rubble pile asteroid like Dimorphos, which orbits the Didymos, the larger of the two, you release a lot of material, and you can get spectrum on that material, and you can find out a lot about the interior of the asteroid. And every piece of asteroid we study, we learn more about the entire solar system in greater detail. So what happened when DART hit Dimorphos in September of 22, the very large telescope in Chile was using its instruments to study Dimorphos before, during, and after the impact. And they got spectrum from it. And what they did is they discovered that this asteroid is extremely dry, bone dry. There's no evidence of water in before, during, or after the impact. In other words, the material that was thrown out of the impact did not show any evidence of water molecules. And what's significant about this is there's been a lot of theories that possibly asteroids in their interior could hold water. And so this tells us a little bit about the solar system in terms of water. It does suggest that if we're going to get water once we go out there, we might have to go places like Mars or farther out than Mars, because the inner solar system, unless you're on Earth, does not appear to have water, at least for so far, close in asteroids, John.
Now we go to the great big robots. Hubble, which Bob has profiled in his biography of Hubble, Universe and Amir, and Webb, the new guy on the block. These are wonderful stories, suggestive to me, a longtime science fiction reader. First, we go to the seasons of Uranus. What have we learned, Bob?
Hubble, over a period of like the last, 20 years, has taken pictures periodically of Uranus. And because this planet rotates on its side, it means that for long periods of time, one side of the planet, the one pole of the planet, is completely away from the sun, and the other part of the planet is facing the sun, because as it's going around the sun, the rotation kind of shifts so that different parts of the planet point. And I got two pictures up in on Behind the Black. One is from 2014 by Hubble, and the other one is 22, which shows that shift. So that in 14, the one of the poles is kind of to the right, and we're looking more at the equator. And now, 8 years later, the planet is now shifted so that that pole is now almost pointing directly at the sun, and the equator now is on the edge. And that means the other pole is getting no sun at all, and will be that way for maybe 40 years in the 84-year, 82-year orbit of this planet. This is part of, the, as you say, the weather reports and climate reporting of the gas giants and the solar system. But it's going to take us centuries to really understand this climate, because we're going to have to watch several different 84-year orbits to before we can really get a sense of the seasonal changes on Uranus.
I just like the whole idea, Bob, of a weather person for the solar system. The seasons on Mars we can talk about now. I don't remember seasons on the moon. Are there? I don't remember that ever coming.
There aren't. Not really. There aren't, because it's pretty much, remember, there's no atmosphere, so there's no real changes over time. You have temperature changes between the long night and the long day. Each one is 14 days long. So for 14 days, you're in darkness, and then for 14 days, you're in sunlight. And so there's great change between the two. And that probably is the closest thing to what the moon has a season.
And the other super robot, the new guy on the block, the James Webb Space Telescope. Bob is going to interpret this. I got really excited when I read it. An exoplanet with an atmosphere of hot sand clouds. Please explain, Bob.
This is an example of the Webb team, as they always overhype all their results because the telescope costs so much. They've got to justify its expense. It's a good result. It's not what they say. The exoplanet is really not an exoplanet. It could be a brown dwarf, a failed star. It's big. It's much bigger than most exoplanets, but it's not quite a dwarf, a brown dwarf. So they don't know exactly which it is. What they detected is silica particles in the atmosphere. And they interpret these as potentially clouds that could settle out, which means they're dust storm. But this is a really stretch, and it sounds cool, and therefore it gets people excited, John. The temperature of these clouds is 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Once again, this could be a brown dwarf, a failed star. What this really tells us is Webb's potential with its infrared capability, since that's what it is, for getting specific details about brown dwarfs and exoplanets and stars that we never could get before. And that's what's really cool about this, John.
Well, my response is immediately I went to Luke Skywalker on the Tatooine farm boy. We're looking at the sandstorms on Star Trek, Star Wars. So, all right, fine. We go now from the two new guys back to somebody who is extremely successful, the Flying Toaster, the 48th flight. Any significant advances, Bob?
Yep, here we really are on Tatooine, where Luke Skywalker walked. This is Mars, which has dust storms and is desert-like in many ways in its equatorial regions. And Ingenuity in the equatorial regions is leapfrogging ahead of Perseverance, and it completed its 48th flight. And I got, as always, I've got a map up on Behind the Black, so you can see where the two vehicles, the rover and the helicopter, now sit relative to each other. Perseverance is right now getting ready to begin a drill campaign for another core sample, I suspect. Ingenuity completed the fourth flight, the 48th flight, flying 1,300 feet, and it landed quite close to a crater that's on the Delta in Jezero crater called Belva. And their original plan was not, at least their planned route, does not have them go close to Belva, but that Ingenuity went close to it suggests to me that they might very well change the course of Perseverance to get closer to the rim of this crater, and I think that would be wise. There's no reason why they cannot go beyond their planned route. Somewhere.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. We're going to Space Engineering. I'm John.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
how to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No.